when it's my responsibility to dismiss them, I forget about 70% of the time. So I was Jeff's backup because he and I are both cut from the same cloth on that one. So that was our pastor, Jeff. If you're new here, I am Jeff, but not our pastor. That's all I'll say about that. We're going to start off with a little video today. Before he starts it, this is a clip from a show Shelley and I watched on kind of a whim. We liked one of the actors in it and thought we'd give it a try. And the premise is it deals with spiritual things. And I'll warn you that if you go off and watch, I'm not sure yet what the point they're making is all the time. There are a lot of twists and turns. It's very entertaining and very interesting. But the premise is, you'll see close enough. The premise is some folks have died, and this is the beginning of their time in the afterlife is the premise of the show. So go ahead, Brian, and Kevin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to your first day in the afterlife. You were all, simply put, good people. But how do we know that you were good? How are we sure? During your time on Earth, every one of your actions had a positive or a negative value, depending on how much good or bad that action put into the universe. Every sandwich you ate, every time you bought a magazine, every single thing you did had an effect that rippled out over time and ultimately created some amount of good or bad. You know how some people pull into the breakdown lane when there's traffic and they think to themselves, ah, who cares? No one's watching. We were watching. Surprise! Anyway, when your time on Earth has ended, we calculate the total value of your life using our perfectly accurate measuring system. Only the people with the very highest scores, the true cream of the crop, get to come here to the good place. What happens to everyone else, you ask? Don't worry about it. The point is, you are here because you lived one of the very best lives that could be lived.
That's it. If you were worried, that's not how it works. But we and a lot of people believe that that's how it works. And even we do sometimes. I keep picking up this water, but I'm not going to drink it right now. Throughout the Old Testament, God took thousands of years to establish for his people that this is not how it works, and they should be very glad that they cannot make it. They cannot be good, and not just good enough, but they can't even consistently stay good. And sometimes when we talk about that, we talk as if God is this overly picky guy, right? We're all better than God. We talk about almost, we don't say this, but I think people could think this because we're forgiving and we let things go and we're not that demanding of each other. And why is God? And what we don't see is that sin is like some chemicals where it only takes a little bit before you can tell and it spreads through and affects everything. The one that I'm familiar with, I used to be a pool operator. It's one of my it's not on my resume anymore, but. But you take chlorine in a pool, and you take out of a million atoms of water, if you put one atom of chlorine, that's enough to keep that pool tasting like pool water. If you put two atoms of chlorine out of a million atoms of water, that's enough to burn your eyes and have people complain. Three atoms of chlorine in a million atoms of pool water will smell. I mean, you walk in and you almost wouldn't want to get in the water. That's how sensitive we are to some chemicals, and that's how much sin permeates what we do, so that even our good actions and even the good actions of Israel were tainted and are tainted today. And God has this problem for us, and we have a problem to deal with. But God has a plan. And Isaiah is at the center stage of revealing that plan. And the worst case scenario has been happening throughout Isaiah. Israel, this nation that God had established, is going to be captured. And they're going to be taken off to another country and ruined, really. But Isaiah tells them that afterwards, God's going to call them back and restore them. But there's a twist. It's still not going to be right. It's still not going to be perfect. And Isaiah hints at a far future, promised one, that's coming, future to him, that will bring it all to a good finish. And Jesus' earliest followers and Jesus himself recognized that those hints in Isaiah were about him. And in fact, in writing the New Testament, they quoted Isaiah more often than any other book in the Bible. And the chapter that we're going to look at today, the passage, it's part of one chapter and all of another, the passage that we're looking at today, among all of those verses in Isaiah, those are quoted more than any other passage in all of the New Testament. This one section that we're talking about today, it's all over the place. After today, go home and read Isaiah 50, last half of 52 and all of Isaiah 53, and then go home and read John. Go home and read 1 Peter, which Jeff did by coincidence this morning and recognized it all over the place. It's all over. This one that we're looking at today. And what God does in this one is he pulls the curtains back and he shines a spotlight on second center stage and he reveals what his plan is more clearly than anywhere else, I think. And think about the road to Emmaus, Luke 24. Brian, this is not on the screen, but Luke 24, the road to Emmaus. Jesus meets with them and he says, didn't the Son of Man have to suffer and die? This is the passage where that comes from. Where Philip is led by the Spirit to go talk to the Ethiopian, the guy from the Ethiopian government, the Ethiopian eunuch. But the point is he's from the government. The passage that he's reading is this passage. It's all over. This is how important this is. And in fact, it so obviously refers to Jesus that people believed, that could not believe that God could foretell things, tell things in the future. They believed that this was written after Jesus and faked, right? Like writing the, you know, having the answers to the test while you're writing it, or while you're answering it. They believed that until 1947, when we found a copy of Isaiah that is absolutely from at least 150 years before Jesus. And here's a picture of that copy. And there's a reason I'm establishing all this. Put that picture up, Brian. Or don't. It's okay. trust me. It's a big scroll, and there's a section of Isaiah, and in fact, it's from all of Isaiah. And do you know how different it was from the versions that we had before to that version? It says the same thing. It's not different. And so keep that in your mind. The passage that we're looking at today is from the last part of Isaiah 52 and all of Isaiah 53. And it's kind of, there we go, okay. If you can read Hebrew, Brian, go to the next one where it highlights on, that's the section we're looking at today. That's it, it's shorter in Hebrew than in English. And I'm not gonna help it in English today, that's for sure. So there are five sections. And more or less today, I'm gonna go through those sections. I don't have a lot of stories. In fact, I have no stories left. I don't have any stories. I'm just going to read through these sections. I'm going to, a couple places, amplify where there's things that are related to it and make it clear what's talking about, but I'm going to kind of let it talk for itself. And Brian and I, you know, I send him verses, and sometimes Brian, I'll say, okay, how are we doing? And he says, it's a lot today. So I don't know why you're here, but you're here for a reason. Hang on with two hands. We're going to go for a ride. So the first verse, Isaiah 52:13. See, my servant will act wisely. Isaiah so far has been talking about this servant, and Jeff in the last couple of weeks has talked about, sometimes it means Isaiah, sometimes it means Israel, but increasingly you get the sense that it's not Israel only that it's talking about. It's talking about this far future promised one, and today that's all it's about. It says, he will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. Jesus recognized that this was about himself and said in John 12, 32 and 33, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. He said this to show the kind of death he was going to die. It was very clear to him, even though maybe it's not so clear until we go through the rest of it, that this is referring to him being lifted up on the cross. And throughout this, we talk about this servant. But it's going to be a mix of some positive and then some negative sounding images. Not negative about the servant, but negative things are going to happen. Verse 14, just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any human being, and his form marred beyond any human likeness, referring to what happened to him on his way to the cross. So he will sprinkle many nations, and kings will shut their mouths in surprise because of him. For what they were not told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand. You can see in verse 14 and 15, it says there were many who were appalled at him. And then the next one it says, but there are many nations that he will sprinkle. What does it mean to sprinkle? What in the world does it mean? This is not a please be neat and wipe the seat kind of sprinkle. In the Old Testament, this is a reference, a very clear reference to cleansing from sacrifice. At Exodus 24:8, establishing the covenant, the covenant after the Exodus between God and his people, Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, "This is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." And then in Mark 14:23-24, Jesus picks up on the same language and he says, "Then he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank from it. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many," he said to them. There's a direct correlation between the scene that Isaiah is describing today and the blood of the covenant that Jesus creates with us, a new covenant. So the next section describes how Jesus was despised and rejected. Isaiah 53, "Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" John 12, 37-38 picks up on this and says, "Even after Jesus had performed so many signs in their presence, they still would not believe in him. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet, 'Lord, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?'" That phrase, the arm of the Lord, that's a common poetic way of referring to the strength, the might of a king, the power of a king, that he could reach out and he's got this strong arm. And so the scene, the picture that Isaiah has been painting might look like this if you were to look at an arm, right? That's this strong arm of the Lord that is going to come and bring salvation and rule. And but in this passage and in other parts of Isaiah, you start to see that he's painting a slightly different picture of the strong arm of the Lord. This is the arm of the picture that they're painting for us. And Isaiah 51:5, well, we'll skip that, Brian. Verse 2, "He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him." The picture here, like a tender root from dry ground, is, if you've seen this, the image that we use for this series is this image right here. That's where this comes from. Here's dry ground, and there's a little flower sprouting out, a tender shoot sprouting out of dry ground. And this is what that refers to. And this is a reference to Jesus coming on the scene and was in the beginning of the Gospels was applauded and followed around by crowds. But then by the end was despised and rejected. And so it's presenting that to us here. Verse 3, "He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised, and we held him in low esteem." This third section of the poem is talks about how we are healed by his wounds. Verse 4, and it flips what we just heard about Jesus. "Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted." Verse 3 said Jesus was a man of suffering and of pain, but verse 4 tells us that that was our suffering and that was our pain. And this is the first turn in this section where it is making it clear that Jesus has been a substitution for us. Jesus is being assigned what we deserve. And it goes on, "But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities," sin. "The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed." References to him being pierced by the nails in his hands, the spear in his side, being crushed, beaten in the flogging that he received before the cross. And then verse 6, "We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all." See, God does have a perfect algorithm that weighs our life for good and for bad. And the hard fact is that the algorithm doesn't work out for any of us. That all of us have gone astray. All of us do continually go astray. And God had a solution in laying on him the punishment for our sin. First Peter 2, Brian, I don't have this. 2:24 and 25. He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that we might die to sins and live for righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed, for you were like sheep going astray, but now you have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. So the fourth section is Jesus was sinless, suffering, and silent. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Jesus is often called the Lamb of God. Did you ever wonder where that came from? The most direct reference connecting Jesus to lamb is this. This is where that originally comes from. And John the Baptist picks up on it. And in John 1:29, it says, "The next day, John saw Jesus coming toward him and said, 'Look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world.'" This is also a reference in the silence to the odd lack of defense that Jesus gave. Jesus, the only one that could give a perfect defense when accused, gave no defense, in part because this is how God wanted this to happen. Verse 8, "By oppression and judgment he was taken away. Yet who of his generation protested? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was punished. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth." The reference there to the rich reminds us of, you remember where Jesus was buried? In Matthew 27, 57 through 60, "As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea," which is not a country, by the way, but a town north of Jerusalem, not far from Nazareth. "The rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself been..." Jesus was buried in a rich manner. "And the will of the Lord..."